Chapter 69. AMS Predator. Bridget woke up almost instantly when Benedict stirred in his sickbed. She sat up in her chair and wiped her hand at her mouth, as she always did. She had a wretched tendency to drool when she slept heavily. But she forgot, and came near to knocking out her teeth when the cast over her forearm and wrist smacked into her lips. Bridget hissed out a curse and raised her unwounded arm to her mouth to rub at the sting. That was all she needed, for Benedict to wake up to see her lips split open and swollen. The young warrior born stirred and let out a soft groan. His body twitched, and then his arms moved, only to be held down by the straps of the infirmary cot he occupied. He opened his eyes and looked around blearily. The infirmary was crowded, with men strapped into cots covering nearly every spare foot of floor space. Dr. Bagan, after labouring for nearly a day straight in the wake of the battle, was in a hammock strung up in one corner of the infirmary, snoring with the force of an approaching thunderstorm. A second hammock had been hung up in the other corner, and Master Ferris lay in it, arms folded over his belly, sleeping with a small contented smile on his face. Folly lay curled up in the open space beneath her mentor's hammock, between the etherealist's two wagons, sleeping with her mouth open.
"Don't try to sit up yet," Bridget said to Benedict. "Here, here, let me unbuckle it."
She leaned down and unfastened the straps that held Benedict flat to his cot, and he took a deeper breath after she had, and raised his hands to mop at his face. Then he lowered them, his eyes snapped into focus, and for a moment there was something wild and dangerous in them. When they locked on her, she felt that she hardly recognized him. Fortunately, Bagan had prepared her in advance for the kind of response a wounded warrior born might have after a battle followed by most of 2 days of unconsciousness. Benedict's accelerated metabolism had burned fiercely for all that time, and he seemed more lean and dangerous than at any other time she had known him. Without a word, she passed him a large tankard that had been sitting ready, and he all but snatched it out of her hands, clutching it clumsily due to the burns and thick bandages over his own. But he guzzled the water down with such urgent thirst that some of it spilled out around the corners of his mouth. By the time he lowered the mug, she had uncovered the large bowl of thick stew and the small loaf of bread that had been waiting with the water. He sat up, took it from her with a growl and a flash of teeth, and began eating the stew directly from the bowl, as if he couldn't get it into his mouth quickly enough. He supplemented gulps of stew with enormous bites off of the loaf of bread, hardly chewing them before he swallowed. Bridget followed Dr. Bacon's instructions and sat very still while Benedict ate, without speaking, moving, or offering to take the bowl from him when he seemed to be done. It was only after he had finished the bowl and the loaf alike that the wildness seemed to die out of his eyes. He blinked them several times, and then abruptly focused on Bridget again. The lower half of his face was stained with his meal. He lifted his hand to his mouth in a short, abortive gesture, and something like shame touched his eyes.
"Ah," he said, his voice low and rough. "I beg your pardon, Miss Tarquin. I was not myself."
"It's all right," she assured him. "How do you feel?"
"Awful."
Something deep and dark flickered in his eyes for a moment, but then it was gone.
"Where are we?"
he asked.
"Aboard Predator, in the infirmary."
He peered around him.
"Ah, how did we get here? We were at the temple, the last thing I knew."
"You collapsed from the silkweaver venom," Bridget said quietly. "We knew Master Ferris could help you, and the others who had been poisoned, so the captain brought everyone aboard and set out to recover Master Ferris's equipment."
"Successfully, obviously,"
Benedict noted.
"What happened?"
He blinked and suddenly sat up straight.
"Bridget, what happened to your face? Your arm.
He lifted a hand and touched her bruised cheek. His fingertips were light and hot and a tiny bit rough. Bridget thought her heart might stop. She felt her eyes grow very round. Benedict's spine seemed to stiffen in the same moment. And then he lowered his hand abruptly and cleared his throat.
That is, if you wish to tell me.
I was struck on the face while the temple was collapsing around us,
Bridget said, which was technically true. She held up her cast.
This happened as the battle began.
What battle?
Oh, we chased down and fought Mistshark, the champion ship of the Olympian Trials, then fought something called an Itasca alongside several ships of the fleet. We captured her, which is apparently quite a significant thing, and now we're bringing everyone from the battle back home.
Bridget sounded to herself like a terribly nervous child reciting poetry for the first time in front of her classmates, speaking too quickly but unable to stop herself. Benedict blinked and shook his head.
How did you say you hurt your wrist?
The ship was manoeuvring, and I was trying to hold on to Raoul. I had no idea the motion could be so violent.
She shook her head and felt herself blushing.
It's nothing, honestly.
Where's Raoul?
Not speaking to me at the moment,
she said.
I'm afraid his pride is wounded, but he'll come around, eventually.
Benedict smiled faintly.
And Gwen?
She's fine, Bridget said. She's good.
The young warrior-born quirked an eyebrow at the thoughtful tone in Bridget's voice.
Yes, she is,
he said quietly. Arrogant, headstrong, occasionally careless and slow to consider that she might be wrong, but she has a good heart, beneath all the annoying bits. Occasionally a goodly distance beneath. Bridget let out a little laugh and shook her head.
You always tease her.
Someone must.
Otherwise she'd get an enormous, swollen Lancaster head. He grinned and looked at her for a moment, then, moving very deliberately, Benedict Sorrelin picked up Bridget's hand and rested her palm atop his fever-hot fingers. He pressed her hand between both of his. Bridget's heart raced, and she felt herself blushing again, and smiling, and staring intently down at her own feet. But then she closed her fingers gently against his, and felt his firm, careful grip tighten in response.
It was amazing, she thought.
She didn't feel a need to say anything, and apparently he didn't either. Her hand was in his, and that was saying enough, and more than enough. She was exhausted, and the past few days had been terrible. But now she sat quietly beside Benedict, and held his hand, and felt happier than she had in months. Gwen stood very quietly on the windy deck, her goggles in place, and stared out over the railing to where a large cargo-loading platform from Itasca had been stacked with the cost of the opening days of the war. There had been no room to lay the bodies of those who had died in state. Instead, they had been wrapped in cloth and stacked up like cordwood, Albions and Aurorans alike. The platform now floated 100 yards from Predator, tethered with a length of line. The deck of Predator was crowded. The officers of Surrender Itasca stood weaponless in their dress uniforms, as did the officers of Valiant and Victorious, and the single surviving officer from Thunderous.
For as much as it has pleased God in heaven to take out of this world the souls of these men,
Captain Grimm intoned, his voice calm and steady, his hat in his hands,
we therefore commit their bodies to the winds, earth to earth, ashes to ashes, and dust to dust, looking for that blessed hope when God in heaven himself shall descend to earth with a shout, with the voices of the archangels, and with the trumpet of God, and when that which is no more shall be again. Then we who are alive and remain shall see a new world born of this vale of tears, and be rejoined with them in peace. Amen.
Amen.
Came a general rumble from the assembled officers and the aeronauts of Predator. "Funeral detail," Creedy said from his place at Grimm's right hand. "Proceed." One of Predator's cannon had been adjusted for the task at hand, and what lanced out from its barrel was not the usual streaking comet of light, but a small, glowing sun. It sailed gracefully toward the float, expanding rapidly, and when it hit, there was a flash of light, a cough of thunder, and a sudden thundercloud made of pure fire, so bright that Gwen had to shield her eyes against it, even in goggles. When she blinked her eyes clear again, the float and the bodies upon it were gone, replaced with a swiftly dissipating cloud of ash and soot, already being taken by the strong breeze. There was a long moment of silence, during which no one moved. Then, as if by an unspoken signal, scores of men suddenly redonned their hats, and the stillness of the funeral service was over. There was a brief period of mingling among the officers, in which the captured Aurorans spoke calmly with their Albion counterparts, differing only in their uniforms, and in that none of them wore gauntlets or blades. Then men began boarding launches and returning to their ships, to Valiant and Victorious, both of them hauling the battered, gutted form of Itasca behind them. Then the three ships began to make their way slowly back toward Spire Albion, moving at only a fraction of the speed that had carried them away from the spire. Gwen waited for several minutes after the ship had gotten under way, and then watched as Captain Grimm returned to his quarters. She followed after, and knocked on his door.
"Enter,"
he said. She slipped off her goggles and went in to find him sitting at the little table in his room, a fresh stack of blank pages in front of him, along with a pen and ink. He set them aside and rose politely as she entered.
"Captain, good afternoon."
"Miss Lancaster," Grimm said. "What can I do for you?"
Gwen found herself clenching her fists on the hem of her jacket and forced herself to stop.
I need to talk to someone, but there's no one about who seems appropriate. If I were at home, I would talk to Esterbrook, but—"
Grimm tilted his head slightly to one side, then he gestured for her to sit down in the other chair and drew it out for her. Gwen sat gratefully.
"Tea?"
he asked her.
I'm not sure this is a tea conversation," Gwen said.
Grimm frowned.
"I pray you, Miss Lancaster, say what is on your mind."
"That's just it," she said. I am not sure what it is. I have a horrible feeling."
Grimm drew in a breath through his nostrils and said,
"Ah, what sort of horrible?"
Gwen shook her head.
"I killed a man a few days ago. An Auroran officer. I chose to do it. He never had a chance."
Grimm nodded slowly.
"And I saw that silkweaver matriarch. I saw it do things."
Grimm said quietly, "Continue." He turned toward a cabinet, opened it, and withdrew a bottle and two small glasses.
And I was here for the battle. I saw—"
Gwen found her throat closing off. She forced herself to speak more clearly.
"It was terrible. When I close my eyes, I'm not quite sure I need to be asleep to have nightmares any more, Captain."
"Aye,"
Grimm said. He returned to the table, poured some of the liquor into each glass, and passed one to her before he sat. Gwen stared down at the glass without really seeing it.
"It's just that I was among these things. I saw these things. And now—"
"Now you're on the way back to be among people who didn't,"
Grimm said quietly. Gwen blinked and felt her eyes widen slightly as she looked up at him.
"Yes. Yes, that's it exactly. I had no idea what the world could be like until I saw it. Felt it."
She shook her head, unable to continue.
"How are you going to talk to someone who has no idea?"
Grimm said, nodding.
"How can you explain something you can't find words for? How can you get someone else to understand something for which they have no frame of reference?"
"Yes,"
Gwen said. Her throat tightened up again.
Yes, that's it exactly.
You can't,
Grimm said simply. You've seen the mist more.
They haven't.
Gwen blinked slightly at that.
Oh, is that what that phrase means? Because I haven't seen a literal Mistmore.
Grimm smiled faintly.
That's what it means, he said. You can describe it to them as much as you want. You can write books about what you felt, what you experienced. You can compose poems and songs about what it was like. But until they've seen it for themselves, they can't really know what it is you're talking about. A few people will clearly see the effect it had on you, will understand that much at least. But they won't know.
Gwen shuddered.
I'm not sure I want them to.
Of course not,
Grimm said.
No one should have to go through that. Why fight, if not to protect others?
Gwen nodded.
I thought perhaps I was going mad.
Possibly, Grimm said. But if so, you won't be alone.
She felt herself smile a little.
What do I do?
In answer, he held up his glass, extending his arm to her. She picked up her own and touched her glass to his. They both drank. The liquor was golden and sweet and strong, and it burned into her as it went down.
Talk to me about it if you wish,
Grimm said.
Or Benedict. Or Miss Targwin. Or Mr. Kettle, if you don't mind the cursing. They've all seen the Mistmore.
And they know how to live with it?
Gwen asked.
I'm not sure anyone knows that,
Grimm said.
But they'll understand you. It helps, I know. And in time, it isn't as hard to bear.
What we've done,
Gwen said quietly.
The violence. The death.
She shook her head, unable to articulate what she felt.
I know,
Grimm said very quietly.
There's a question you need to ask yourself.
Oh?
He nodded.
If you could go back to exactly those moments, with exactly the knowledge you had at the time, would you do it any differently?
Don't you mean, if I knew then what I know now?
No, he said firmly. I mean exactly the opposite of that. You can't see the future, Miss Lancaster. You cannot be aware of all things at all times. In combat situations, your choices can be judged based only against what you knew at the time. To expect anything more of a soldier is to demand that he or she be superhuman, which seems, to me, unreasonable.
Gwen frowned, thinking, turning the empty glass in her fingers.
If I had done anything differently, I think I would be dead right now.
There you have it,
Grimm said simply.
But I feel horrible,
Gwen said.
Good, Grimm said. You ought to. Anyone ought to.
It doesn't seem very soldierly.
He shook his head.
The moment you can see the Mistmore without feeling horrible, you aren't a soldier anymore, Miss Lancaster. You're
something of a monster, perhaps.
You seem all right,
Gwen said.
Seem. Yes.
Grimm gave her a smile with a bitter tinge to it and poured himself another drink. He held up the bottle and she shook her head. He put the bottle back down and threw back the drink in a single swallow.
I'm not, but I haven't the luxury to fall apart just yet. I'll be a gibbering wreck later, I assure you. But for the moment, there is work to do. I know what you are feeling.
Gwen nodded and felt a shudder go through her, and then leave her body feeling a fraction less tense, a fraction less painful. He was right. It helped.
It's funny,
she said.
Miss?
After the way I left, I suddenly find myself wanting very much to go home. But it won't be the same when I get back, will it?
It will be the same,
Grimm said. You're the one who has changed.
Oh,
she said quietly. They sat in silence for a moment, then Gwen rose and put her glass back down on the table. Grimm rose with her.
Captain Grimm?" she said. "Thank you."
He bowed his head to her and said,
"Of course."
Raoul crouched in his newly claimed lair and contemplated which was the greater evil, to return to his home in his current condition or to fling himself off the side of the airship. That he could not readily discern the answer to his question spoke volumes of his situation. Perhaps ending it all would be better. He could not face his clan as he was. Foolish humans, to make their airship in such a fashion as to maim a cat who was there only to guide and protect them. It was a wonder they hadn't exterminated themselves centuries ago. Raoul stirred and moved with considerable pain to rise and lie down on his other side. The inside of this crate smelled like sawdust, but its open mouth faced one of the airship's walls, so at least his crippling hideousness was not on display for every human who might walk by. He heard when Little Mouse approached the crate for the fourth time.
"Raoul," she said, "this is foolish. You need to come out."
"Go away, Little Mouse," Raoul replied. "I am contemplating suicide."
"You can't be serious,"
Little Mouse said.
"Perfectly serious," he replied. "I cannot go home like this."
"Oh, for pity's sake," Bridget sighed.
Her heavy boots walked away, and Raoul went back to his brooding. He had almost perfected it when the boots approached again, and someone lifted the crate and turned it 90 degrees to one side. Little Mouse leaned down and peered into the crate, frowning.
"Raoul, you've been in there for 2 days, and we've landed back at Spire Albion. Are you ready to come out yet?"
"I will never come out,"
Raoul said morosely.
"I am a freak."
"Merciful builders," Little Mouse sighed. "Would you please come out and talk to me?"
Raoul shuddered. Little Mouse was his friend, but he did not owe her everything. He should not have to display his freakishness for her entertainment.
"Please," she said. "Raoul, you're beginning to frighten me."
Raoul rolled his eyes. That was a ploy, a cheap one, trying to gain his sympathy because her odd human face was contorted with concern and affection. But it was Little Mouse's ploy. He rose, stiffly and uncomfortably, and then began his asymmetrical, halting, hideous limp to bring him out of the crate. The horrible thing on his right front leg and paw clacked against the wooden deck with each loathsome, short, unbalanced step.
"If I asked you,"
Raoul said,
"would you kill me, please?"
"I would not."
"You are a terrible friend,"
Raoul said. He tried to move his leg, which itched horribly, but the deformity kept him from being able to scratch it. He had tried.
"For goodness sake, Raoul," Little Mouse said. "It's just a cast. The bone will heal. Why are you so upset about it?"
"Look at it,"
Raoul said spitefully.
"It is hideous. It is the most hideous thing there has ever been."
In answer, Little Mouse held up her broken arm with its similar cast and said nothing. Raoul lowered his ears a little.
"That is beside the point. Humans always look foolish and clumsy. I am a cat and the prince of the silent paws. There is no comparison to be made."
"And my head," Raoul said. He would have shaken it for emphasis, but shaking would not make the cloth the human butcher had fastened there come loose, and it made his legs feel oddly unsteady when he tried.
"Look at my head, and beneath it the fur was shaved. I look like I have mange."
"You don't have..."
"Oh, Raoul,"
Little Mouse said.
"You don't need someone to help you commit suicide. You need proper food and rest."
"I no longer need interest myself with food,"
Raoul said.
He summoned up as much of his shattered dignity as he could and turned to begin walking deliberately toward the stern of the airship, which protruded out into empty air. "No," Little Mouse said firmly. She caught up to him in two strides and reached for him. Raoul tried to dodge, but the monstrous cast on his leg slowed him, and Little Mouse scooped him up, made a cradle of her arms, and hugged him gently. It gave him a brief, glowing surge of delight, which was cheating.
"Little Mouse," Raoul said, "you are squishing my fur."
She held him a little closer and said, "Yes, you are my oldest friend. I would be lost without you." Raoul hadn't considered the issue from that angle before.
"Of course you would."
"If you like, you can stay with me until Dr. Bagan says the cast can come off. Then no one from the tribe need see you."
"You are trying to bribe me out of an honorable death,"
Raoul said in severe tones.
"I just sent a runner to purchase your favorite dumplings."
At the very mention of the food, Raoul's stomach gurgled hungrily, which was also cheating. He let out a heavy, heavy sigh.
"Fine," he said. "But know you, Little Mouse, that I would endure this humiliation for no one else."
She rubbed her face into the fur of his back, and Raoul felt himself purring, which was cheating only if he was still trying to kill himself, which he now was not, he had decided. So he rolled over in Little Mouse's cradled arms so that he could nuzzle her back while she nuzzled him, if only for a moment, patting her face with his uninjured front paw. Then he said,
"Where?"
Little Mouse blinked.
"Where what?"
"Where are my dumplings?"
Grim sat quietly across from Addison, Orson, Magnus, Jeremiah, Albion, Spyrarch of Albion, until he had finished scanning the pages of Grim's written report. The Spyrarch, Grim noted, read very, very quickly.
"I see," Albion said, "that no mention was made of putting the captured crew of Itasca in chains."
"They weren't," Grim replied. Albion arched an eyebrow and looked up at Grim over the rims of his spectacles.
"Captain Castillo gave us his parole, and that of his crew."
The Spyrarch's other eyebrow climbed.
"Just like that?"
"More or less," Grim said.
"We could have shot them down. We didn't."
Albion pursed his lips thoughtfully, and then turned back to the report with a faint smile.
"Tell me about our losses."
"Thunderous was shot down. She took heavy casualties, 153 dead, including all but one of her junior officers, and 40 injured, but managed to stay afloat on her trim crystals until rescue launches could find her in the mist."
"It says here," Albion said, "that special commendation should be given to Captain Castillo and his marines, who aided in the rescue effort."
"Itasca had more functional launches than all of us together," Grim said. "No marine or aeronaut wants to see anyone fall to the surface."
"And why is that?"
"Because we all have nightmares about it," Grim said. "The fighting was over, so they helped."
"And none tried to escape,"
Albion said.
Grim shook his head once firmly.
"They had given their parole."
"I see,"
Albion murmured.
"In your opinion, is Thunderous salvageable?"
Salvage operations were always terribly risky affairs. One never knew what horrors one might face in a simple mission to recover the precious lift and core crystals from a downed ship. After all, one had to risk a ship to attempt to recover a ship. And the success rate of such recoveries always wavered precariously between sustainability and throwing good crystals after bad.
"I'm not a salvage expert, sire," Grim said, "but we're in a war with Aurora now. We don't have the luxury of playing it safe."
Albion tapped a thumbnail on his desk, musing over the statement.
"Sire?"
"Yes, Captain?"
"What is going to happen to the Aurorans?"
"They are prisoners of war," Albion said. "I should imagine they will be set to work at the base of the spire."
Grim tightened his jaw.
No, sir.
No?
No, sir, Grim said.
I've seen that place.
You might as well tie a noose around their necks and stand them on blocks of ice if you want them to die a slow death. It will be cleaner.
I'm not sure why this concerns you, Captain,
Albion said.
Because they surrendered to me, Grim said. They gave me their parole, sir. They could have fought on with no real chance of victory, and it would have been bloody. But that surrender saved blood and lives of Albions and Aurorans alike. I will not see Captain Castillo repaid with such churlish treatment.
Albion said. He nodded to the report and said, Continue.
Victorious took moderate casualties among her crew, with 11 dead and 41 injured. She took heavy damage to her hull and mast works, but can be repaired within 10 days. Valiant took only light damage, with no deaths and half a dozen injuries. And Commodore Bayard already has her back in fighting condition.
And Predator?
22 men dead, in all, Grim replied, careful to think only of numbers. 33 injured.
We lost a single heavy cruiser,
Albion mused,
and captured Itasca.
What's left of her?
Grim said.
In Bayard's report, Albion said, he notes that the only reason Itasca could be taken at all was because you lured her into pursuing Predator.
It was the right thing to do, Grim said.
Yes,
Albion said.
And many men recognize the right thing to do. But when it means putting themselves at risk, relatively few will still do it.
Grim felt a sudden flare of rage in his chest.
Rook, he said.
Your report, Albion noted, accuses him of cowardice in the face of the enemy.
It does,
Grim said.
He got scared. He ran. If Glorious had stood fast, we wouldn't have lost Thunderous and might well have taken Itasca whole and functioning.
So it says in your report,
Albion said.
Commodore Rook's report to the Admiralty reads somewhat differently. He claimed that blast concussion shorted the leads to his lift crystal temporarily, and that he could not maintain altitude.
He's a damned liar, Grim said. Ask Bayard.
I did, Albion said. Commodore Bayard reports that he was too far from the fighting, and at too poor an angle of visibility to see what happened clearly, and cannot in good conscience swear to the truth of either report. Without his testimony, I'm afraid it is your word against Commodore Rook's.
Grim ground his teeth. He was outcast from fleet. Rook was the darling of one of the many factions within its command structure. Shall I ask Captain Castillo for the courtesy of a report?
Albion threw back his head and barked out a short laugh. I believe you. I'm certain the good captain would back up your report. But I'm afraid his word wouldn't carry much weight with Fleet Admiralty either.
Grim's spine felt like rigid copper-clad iron.
So he just gets away with it, sire?
He gets away with it, Albion said. For now.
Grim heard his knuckles pop as he clenched his hand into a frustrated fist.
Yes, sire.
Albion regarded him steadily for a moment and then set aside the report and folded his hands into a pointed steeple.
Off the record, he said, how would you review Albion's performance in this crisis?
We failed, sire,
Grim said.
In what way?
We didn't stop the attack on landing.
Our enemies escaped after burning down a priceless collection of knowledge. Innocents died. The landing shipyard was destroyed. There's only a single bright point in all of this mess.
That being?
Grim withdrew 2 identical volumes from the pocket of his coat and laid them on Albion's desk.
This is what Cavendish and the Aurorans were after. She took 1 copy and burned every other one she could find.
One of the monks managed to bring one out of the fire, and I took the stolen book back from her prior to Ataska's arrival.
Albion put his fingers on the books very, very slowly. He drew them both toward him and separated them so that they lay side by side.
You did not mention these in your report.
No, sire.
The Aurorans went to an awful lot of trouble to get that book. It seemed best not to mention it in any kind of record.
Albion nodded slowly.
Indeed, Captain.
You did precisely the right thing.
He took both books and swept them into his desk drawer.
This entire incident has been extremely unfortunate.
It could have been more so, Grimm said.
Huh?
The criminal guilds in Landing, sire. If they hadn't intervened and coordinated firefighting efforts and evacuation, a lot more people would have died. We might have lost the entire Habel.
Yes,
Albion said.
We were fortunate they reacted so quickly.
Aye, Grimm said. It was almost like someone warned them of what was coming, sire.
Albion blinked once slowly and gave Grimm a bland look.
What are you implying, Captain?
You couldn't trust your own guard, Grimm said. But you needed someone with the numbers and the muscle and the organization to do the job. And while the motivation of the guilds might be distasteful, it is utterly constant. Money.
That is a very interesting theory, Captain Grimm,
Albion said.
But it isn't terribly credible, I'm afraid.
I'm a figurehead of the government and little more. Everyone knows that.
Oh, Grimm said. My mistake.
Neither man smiled, but Albion inclined his head very slightly to Grimm, like a fencer acknowledging a touch.
Why, sire? Grimm asked. Why would they want that book?
I'm not sure,
Albion said.
I suppose we could ask.
Itasca's officers and crew won't know a thing about it, beyond their movement orders and objectives, Grimm said. That's basic military security.
Then we must ask this Madame Cavendish, I should think.
Albion looked up at him.
Can we catch Mist Shark?
The moment Captain Ransom got back to her ship, she'd have taken her down into the mist and raised sail.
Grimm said, she's a smuggler.
You could send half a fleet to hunt her, sire, and never see so much as her shadow.
And that is your professional opinion?
Albion asked, his eyes narrowing slightly.
No, sire. It is a fact.
Albion said.
Well, at least they didn't get the book.
The storm roiled all around Mist Shark. Unpredictable winds buffeted the airship randomly and violently, sometimes shoving her back and forth, and more often sending her hurling violently up or down. Espera sat through it on the floor, his safety harness strapped tightly and securely, his back against the hull. His men were Auroran marines, used to bad weather in airships. But even so, after 3 days of wind-driven propulsion, more than a few had been forced to clutch for a bucket as they lost the contents of their stomachs. Espera closed his eyes and drifted in limbo until some unspecified amount of time later, Siriaco tapped his shoulder, waking him.
Again,
the sergeant said. He sighed and hauled himself to his feet. He unfastened the safety harness and began the laborious process of traversing the length of Mist Shark to get to Madame Cavendish's cabin.
Espera was tired. He didn't feel like knocking, but simply barging in would have been impolite, and he wanted to live to see Spire Aurora again.
He knocked, and a moment later Sark opened the door. The big warrior-born looked leaner, like a half-starved cat, but he was up and moving again despite the terrible injuries he had suffered. He grunted and stepped back from the door as Espera entered. Madame Cavendish looked a fright. Her hair was mussed, her sleeves had been rolled up, and ink smudged her fingers and made a random spatter of droplets on her lean forearms. She grimly gripped a quill, as if the muscles in her hand had long since locked into position from overuse, and she was writing furiously on a piece of paper. A stack of several hundred more pieces of paper sat on the table beside her, their edges lined up with maniacal precision, and every one of them was covered in her bold, angular writing. She finished the page she was on, the last, blew across it gently to help dry the ink, and then carefully placed it atop the stack. She sat back from it slowly, her eyes gleaming, and only after a moment of silence did she acknowledge Espira.
"Major,"
she said.
"Madame?"
"I need the use of some of your men. Copies must be made of these pages."
Espira frowned. "Had the woman..."
"Madame?"
Espira asked.
"Did you write this from memory?"
"Why do you think I've been sitting here writing for the past 3 days?"
Cavendish said in a waspish tone.
"Why do you think I yielded the book to Captain Ransom when the Albions overhauled us?"
I see,"
Espira said.
"Madame, I will make inquiries about which of my men can read and write, but you should know that they aren't chosen as Aurora Marines for their penmanship."
"Acknowledged,"
Cavendish said.
"It must be done."
"If I may be so bold,"
Espira said,
"may I ask what was in the book that was so important?"
"Names, Major,"
Cavendish said, her eyes glinting with hungry, fey sparks.
"Names."
Folly sat up, screaming, and kept on screaming until she realized how uncomfortable it was. Her cries died out to little whimpers, and then she shivered and felt tears on her cheeks. Master Ferris came clomping up the ladder to her loft, his wild white hair waving, his face concerned.
"Folly?"
She tried to speak, but her voice came out very quietly.
"Again, Master, I dreamed it again."
"Tell me,"
he said. Folly shivered.
"I dreamed a spire, surrounded in darkness, with death pouring in through its walls. I dreamed of 1,000 ships like crystal, rising from the earth. And wherever they went, people died."
She shivered and took a breath before finishing in a whisper.
"I saw a spire fall, collapse, as if it had been made of sand. And I dreamed of Predator on fire, burning, breaking up, men falling from her like tiny toys."
The memory of their screams of panic brought tears to Folly's eyes again. When she blinked them free, the Master was regarding her with compassion.
"Master,"
Folly said quietly,
"these are not dreams, are they?"
"No,"
he said, his voice rough.
"It is the future."
"Yes."
Folly shivered. He put a hand on her shoulder and rested his forehead against hers, his eyes closed. She leaned against him, grateful for his simple proximity.
"Why am I having these dreams?"
"Because it is beginning."
"What is beginning?"
"The end,"
Ferris replied. His tone was heavy, weary.
"Master?"
"Yes, Folly."
"I'm frightened."
"So, my child,"
the etherealist said.
"So am I."
This is Ewan Morton. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Aeronauts Windlass, The Cinder Spires by Jim Butcher. This program was directed by Bruce Mann. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2015 by Jim Butcher. Production copyright 2015, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.